Hello, hello, and welcome to Art House Garage, the snob-free film podcast where we make art house, indie, classic, and foreign cinema accessible to the masses. I am your host, Andrew Sweatman, and today we've got a review of the new film from Joe Wright and starring Peter Dinklage, Cyrano. After that, I'll talk about some of the other movies I've been watching before bringing you another episode in the series I've been doing on religion and film. This time, I talk with cinephile and tattoo artist Kat Arkana about the 2015 Robert Eggers film, The Witch. Stay tuned.
He's here.
Cyrano?
Cyrano.
Pleasure to meet you, Cyrano de Bergerac.
You're a freak. Freak.
My dearest friend, I'd be very angry with you if you died.
My sole purpose on this earth is to love Roxanne.
Does she know?
The world will never accept someone like me and a tall, beautiful woman.
We have no money. A clever marriage is your only option.
I won't be rescued. I'm not in distress.
Love, does that mean nothing to you?
Children need love. Adults need money.
I need something to die for. Write poems and cry for. And I won't be ashamed. I'd give anything for someone to say.
Confession to make. I am madly in love.
Perhaps he feels the same.
But I've never actually spoken to him.
Of your love?
Of anything. He is Christian. Christian Nubilet. He's a new recruit in your regiment.
Of course he is.
A woman like Roxanne wants wit, romance, poetry. I don't know how to speak romantically.
I am a poet. My words upon your lips. I will make you romantic. Will you make me handsome?
She loves me!
I give anything for someone to say. All the words I don't have tonight.
That was the trailer for Cyrano, the newest film from director Joe Wright and starring Peter Dinklage, Hayley Bennett, and Kelvin Harrison Jr. Cyrano tells the classic story of Cyrano de Bergerac, only in this version, instead of being mocked for having a large nose, Cyrano is ostracized and ridiculed because of his dwarfism. The story follows Cyrano as he pines after Roxanne, before she confesses her love for another man, Christian. Christian has feelings for Roxanne too, but he doesn't have the words to express himself. Cyrano is known for his wit and poetry, and he agrees to write love letters to Roxanne on Christian's behalf. What could go wrong? As you heard in the trailer, this version of the story is also a musical. My big question going into this film was, how is Peter Dinklage's singing voice? And the answer is, pretty good. He sounds best in the slower songs with his deep, rich bass fitting nicely with the lush, romantic tone of the film.
Have you ever wanted something so badly you cannot breathe? Have you ever loved someone madly?
The music for the film is by Bryce and Aaron Dessner. Notably, they also did the music for the recent film, Come On, Come On, which I loved, and they are the songwriters for the alternative rock band, The National. Funnily enough, Peter Dinklage's deep voice sounds a bit like Matt Berninger, the lead singer for The National. I'm a big fan of that band, so the music here really worked for me. One more piece of trivia for the Taylor Swift fans out there, Aaron Dessner is also one of the songwriters she collaborated with on her most recent two albums, Folklore and Evermore. Back to Peter Dinklage. This film really plays to his strengths as an actor. I'm a big fan of his work in Game of Thrones. In fact, two of my favorite plot lines in the entire show center around his character, Tyrion Lannister. One is in season 2 when he's being sly and dealing with all the political intrigue at King's Landing. And the other is his romantic relationship later in the series with Shay, which, at least initially, is incredibly sweet, and he's so good in the romantic scenes. Peter Dinklage is very good when he's being shrewd and when he's being tender, and that's exactly who he gets to be as Cyrano. Joe Wright, the director behind Cyrano, is also responsible for films like Pride and Prejudice and Atonement, and this film feels similar to some of his other work in how heightened and romantic the production design and the costuming is. If anything, Cyrano is even more fanciful and dreamy than Wright's other films. It feels almost like a fairy tale at times. But that dreamy quality belies the fact that the film has some real dramatic heft, and even gets pretty dark by the end. Cyrano, apart from being a gifted writer, speaks truth to power and has occasional threats to his life, and there's also a war sequence in the film's third act. But beyond those elements, the romance itself goes to some really tough places, which impressed me. And there are some very nice touches in the screenwriting as well. In the film's opening, we first see Roxanne riding in her carriage, singing about how she'd give anything to be loved. I initially thought the film was setting her up as unique in this longing, that maybe she's the town's hopeless romantic, but she pulls up to the party she's attending, and as she enters, everyone joins in singing. We get moments of random people in the crowd singing the same song quietly to themselves, wishing desperately to find a steadfast, loving relationship. Love is in the air in this film, and I really appreciate the way this scene plays out and seems to say, we all long for a connection like this. Roxanne's struggle is universal in a way. The central three performers, by the way, all sound great. I've already discussed Peter Dinklage, but Kelvin Harrison Jr., who plays Christian, also has a great singing voice, and Haley Bennett as Roxanne is phenomenal. She's the standout for me musically in this film. A film like Cyrano works best if it successfully sweeps you up in its storytelling, and that's exactly the experience I had with it. I did have a few quibbles with it. There's one or two musical numbers I didn't care for, and there are a few vocalists whose acting is stronger than their singing, and I also thought the film's ending could have been a bit better executed, but those are relatively minor issues. If you're someone who likes a good musical or an immersive period romance, Cyrano is both of those things, and I highly recommend it. I gave Cyrano 4 out of 5 stars, and it is now playing in theaters. When I'm watching a movie, I love to have a little snack, and I'm a big, big fan of popcorn. I recently discovered a company who makes popcorn I love so much, I decided to become an affiliate. So yes, this is an ad, but I will never try and sell you on something I don't love myself. The product is called O-Pop-Pop. They make flavor-wrapped popcorn kernels, which means you can get a variety of tasty flavors on your popcorn straight from the microwave without having to pop and season it yourself on the stove. It comes in savory and sweet flavors like salted umami, vanilla cake pop, Cinnalicious, which is like a cinnamon roll, and spicy cheddar. Right now, they also have some delicious holiday flavors, and you can try them all and get 10% off your first order by going to arthousegarage.com/popcorn. And the link is in the show notes. All right, back to the show. And now it's time for a segment called What Have You Been Watching Lately?, in which I tell you some of the other things I've been watching lately. Just a few things this week. I watched King Richard to round out my Best Picture nominees for the Oscars. This is directed by Ronaldo Marcus Green, and it stars Will Smith and Anjanue Ellis. This follows the story of Richard Williams, the father of Venus and Serena Williams, and tells the true story of his plan for their rise to stardom. So this is a fairly predictable sports drama, but I was interested to see it because I actually played tennis in high school. So I have a little bit of a connection and have always thought very highly of Venus and Serena Williams. And as predictable as this film is, the story is really powerful. It's best when it is focusing on the family and the kind of the unusual family dynamics because of his parenting style. He really did make a plan and write it like a business plan for these two of his daughters to become tennis stars. And he carries it out, and that's exactly how it goes, which is just really unusual and remarkable. It's also a kind of an ethical gray area, right? Because he doesn't really give his daughters a choice in the matter. And I wish the film had leaned into the messiness of that a bit more. There is one neighbor who tells him, you shouldn't be raising them this way. But those are, just a few minutes of screen time in this 2 hour plus, I think it's 2.5 hours almost, film. And we don't get a whole lot about how the daughters felt about this. The film seems to depict that they went right along with it and loved playing and that it, obviously worked out very well. Because this is focused on the parent character more than the daughters, those kind of parenting ethics, I think, could have been fertile ground to explore a bit more. In the end, I did really enjoy this, as predictable as it was. When the music swelled at the end for the big emotional moment, I teared up a little bit, so it did its job well. Will Smith is really great, and so is Anjanou Ellis. It seems like Will Smith is probably going to win the Oscar, I would imagine, and I'm happy that that is the case. I think this performance is very strong, and I'm glad that he's going to be recognized after being nominated a handful of times before. King Richard is available on demand, and I gave it 3.5 out of 5 stars. Next up is a film called Lovers Rock. This is a film directed by Steve McQueen. It's part of an anthology of 5 films called the Small Axe series. This is the 2nd film in the series. The entire series is focused on West Indian immigrants in London and this kind of subculture that I believe Steve McQueen grew up in. And each film looks at a different aspect of the culture. Most of them are pretty moving dramas. The first film in the series is called Mangrove, and it's like a legal drama that's very, very good as well. But this one is a bit of an outlier and my favorite in the series. Lovers Rock tells the story of a house party. It starts with people moving furniture and setting up these big speakers. You don't quite know what they're doing at first. And then you see women in the kitchen cooking all kinds of different things. And then the camera zooms out at one point and you see the outside of the door and there are signs that say the names of the food and how much they cost. And you realize this is like the concession stand for this party. And people come, the DJs play this incredible reggae music that the film really gives a lot of time to the music. And I at least for the first time kind of saw the appeal of reggae, and not that I ever hated it, but it wasn't a genre that I knew much about. But you really see a lot of diversity within the genre, and you see people appreciating it, and this is their music, this is their culture, and they love it. It's kind of a hangout movie. It's a very loose plot. It's a collection of beautiful moments, and there are some also really awful moments within this. And that's what's interesting about it, is the tone is mostly really upbeat, but it does pause and have these dramatic moments. One in particular, very dark moment. But beyond that, there's also the constant threat of racism, which is present throughout all 5 films in this series. But it really sets up that this home that all these people come to is kind of a safe space, a rare safe space, perhaps. At a few points, people wander just, a block away and are met by thugs, racially motivated thugs who are threatening them with violence. So within the house, there's a lot of time spent on the dance floor and some really just beautiful camera work as we see all these fast dancing, slow dancing, all kinds of things. There's one song where it's sort of kind of becomes guy's night for a second, and it's almost a mosh pit, and it's just really incredible to see. I mean, even the extras in this film are really a part of the fabric of it. And it's just, it's so human and so filled with joy and just deep emotion. And just in passing little moments, you get to know so much about all these characters, most of whom we don't even know their name. But it's really a remarkable film, incredibly well put together. The story does follow a young woman who sneaks out of her home to attend this party, meets up with a friend, they get on the train. And so you kind of get this London scene, and then arrives at the house, and she, over the course of the night, falls in love. And that's sort of the main anchor of the story, although there's a lot of side stories, and again, it's very loose. It really is a hangout movie. The party goes all night, and one of the most amazing moments in the film is near the very end. The two lovers are riding a bike and headed to his workplace, actually. But we get this amazing shot where we see them gliding along, but they're just at the bottom of the frame, and we see the trees and the sunlight above them as it's now morning, and we can't see the bike. The bike is just out of frame, so they're just gliding along, and it really is sort of this visualization of the feeling of being in love, and they seem weightless and are floating in the frame, and it's a really wonderful transcendent moment in this incredible, incredible film. This was actually my number two favorite film of 2020, back when it came out, and I made my top 10 list that year. I gave this film 5 out of 5 stars, and it is now streaming on Amazon Prime. And just one more thing, I watched Tick, Tick, Boom. This is the directorial debut of Lin-Manuel Miranda, written by Stephen Levinson and Jonathan Larson, based on his musical. It stars Andrew Garfield, who has been nominated for an Oscar for his performance. It follows the life of Jonathan Larson, just a few weeks in his life. He's the creator of Rent. And I found this film really moving and incredibly well acted. It's a lot about creativity and kind of the pull between living a creative life and following your dreams and your art, or falling back to a more traditional, financially stable life. Andrew Garfield is amazing. I'm very glad that he was nominated for this, for the Oscar. I'd be happy if he won, although I do think it's probably going to be Will Smith. But there are a lot of great musical numbers, some very exciting cameos, and it's fun and moving, I'd say, in pretty much equal measure. There are a few drawbacks. The direction is solid, but it did feel like it mostly played it safe. There's an awful lot of shots of a person singing, and the camera is just slowly circling around them. We get that shot over and over, which is fine, but it's just not the most exciting direction. There are also some choices made. I don't know if this is at the script level or at the direction level, but a few choices that just didn't quite work for me. For instance, there's a conversation that we know is coming between Jonathan and his girlfriend, and he's kind of been avoiding the issue, and we know it's going to be very dramatic when it does arrive, and it finally gets here. And so the construction of the film is that it's a one-man show, one man plus a band, and he's sort of narrating and singing and telling the story of the film that we're watching. And so it's Andrew Garfield as Jonathan Larson on stage telling the story, and then we're cutting to watching it happen, and it kind of goes back and forth. So during this scene, this big dramatic conversation argument we were expecting, it sets up a song to happen at the same time, and it cuts in between the song being performed and the actual conversation being had, and I didn't like this for two reasons. One, I really wanted to hear the details of the conversation and give that some space to breathe and like really sit in that, because it was this dramatic thing I've been waiting to happen. And also because the song that's playing at the same time, it's a song about relationship arguments. And it's also very silly, like intentionally very over the top silly. Andrew Garfield is making really silly faces as he sings it. And like he commits to it and it's great, but it really... I see why they did it. Like I get the choice. I just wish it would have been probably done in a more traditional way. I know I just criticized the movie for being too safe, and then here's one thing that it did that was not safe that I did not really like. But there are some other choices, a few other things that were outside the box that I did like. There's a scene, a brunch scene, that if you've seen the film, you'll know what I'm talking about. But it's a stressful day at the diner where he works, at the Moondance Diner, and that's a standout scene, absolutely, for me for the film. In the end, I did find it quite emotional and a fitting tribute to Jonathan Larson. I'm very glad this film exists and that I got to see it. You can see it as well on Netflix now, and I gave it 4 out of 5 stars. And that is what I've been watching lately. And now it's time to turn to our ongoing series on faith and the movies called The Art of Deconstruction, Faith, Doubt, and Film. Today's guest is someone I met online through mutual friends. She's a tattoo artist, she's a big fan of folk horror, and she loves cinema. Her name is Kat Arkana, and I had a wonderful time talking with her about her spiritual life and how it has changed drastically over the years. The film she selected is Robert Eggers' 2015 folk horror powerhouse, The Witch. This is a film I've seen a handful of times before, and it just gets better every time I watch it. The story follows a Puritan family in 1630s New England as they are banished from their town over a religious dispute. They move out and settle in the wilderness near a forest that may or may not be haunted by a witch. There are a number of religious themes running through this film and many religious conversations between the characters, so it is a great film to discuss in this series. The film stars Anya Taylor-Joy in her debut role, as well as Ralph Ineson and Kate Dickey. The film is also gorgeously shot and filled with incredibly rich period detail, in addition to being genuinely horrifying in many places. We do not spoil the ending of this film in our conversation, so listen away if you haven't seen it. But The Witch also has an incredible ending that I will highly recommend if you haven't seen it. So, without further ado, let's get into it. Here first is a clip of the film's trailer, followed by my conversation with Kat Arkana about The Witch.
What went we out into this wilderness to find? Leaving our country, kindred, our fathers' houses. For what? For the kingdom of God. Let us pray.
Welcome to the podcast, Kat Johnson, aka Kat Arkana. How are you today?
I'm great, Andrew. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. I'm excited to do this. So we've, you know, just recently met through Facebook, really, and mm-hmm. through mutual friends. And I'm excited to kind of get to know you a little bit better on the fly here as we hear about you. One thing you told me when we spoke before was that you're really into folk horror. What about that genre appeals to you?
Oh, man. So folk horror was a genre that I sort of stumbled into a few years back when one of my best friends introduced me to The Wicker Man, the original. And I was like, whatever this weird genre is, I want to know more about it. So I just sort of dove in and found myself going through all of them.
Nice. Yeah, it's a genre I've always meant to get more into. And it's today's film that we're going to talk about, The Witch. I have seen before, but like I've never seen The Wicker Man. I've never seen, I don't know, any of the big kind of big titles. I've seen that there's like a, I think Shudder has a bunch of folk horror stuff right now that I would love to dive into if I had the time. But yeah, so I'm excited to hear your kind of reaction to this film. And yeah, I'm excited to get into it. Well, as we've been going through this series, we're talking to people about their kind of their faith journey and how their faith has changed over the years. So first question to you is, tell us about yourself and as much detail as you're comfortable with, how your faith has kind of evolved or changed over the years.
Yeah, absolutely. So I grew up in a very evangelical Christian home. My dad was a youth pastor. And so the Bible was, it was super important. The church was super important. I probably spent every Wednesday and Sunday there since I was born. So church was a big deal for us. And then eventually I went to a Christian college, Biola University in Los Angeles. And, you know, you would think I would become more religious going, but by meeting so many different kinds of Christians or like people of varying faiths, it really sort of opened my eyes to, you know, there's all different interpretations. There's all different, you know, faiths and people's behavior. And I don't know, it just sort of opened my eyes to a different world of possibility other than Southern Baptist Protestant that I was fed for so many years.
Absolutely. That resonates so much with me. I went to a Christian college also, and you know, you expect that you become more devout, but it kind of funny how that happens. It kind of can swing the other way, and you can still become exposed to other viewpoints and in a good and healthy way, I think. But sorry to interrupt you.
Oh, no, that's perfect. Yeah. So that's basically it for me. So I became, I was Protestant, and then I thought, well, maybe I could be a little more deistic, maybe I could be atheistic, maybe I could be pagan, maybe, you know, just trying different things.
Yeah. do you feel like you've settled anywhere, or is it still a journey of whatever is working?
You know, I do feel like it's always a journey. I like to think that I'm just sort of a skeptic, but open to all the possibilities. I like just hearing people's stories, and you know, if faith is meaningful to some people, like, that's great, that's awesome. Growing and learning.
I like that. And so for a job, you are a tattoo artist, right?
I am, yes.
Yeah, that's really cool. Well, tell us about the film that you selected today. The Witch is one that I've seen a few times. So I guess just people who haven't seen it, what's it about, who's in it, that kind of thing.
All right. So The Witch is a 2015 film directed by Robert Eggers, and it was a stylized version. It's called A New England Folktale. So it's supposed to be set in the 1630s. And it's really a great period piece of a family, a Puritan family that came over from England that has now become separated from their community. And then a bunch of weird stuff happens. They go out on their own, in a farm, and there's maybe the devil, maybe witchcraft. But it gets pretty wild.
It does, yes. Yeah, Robert Eggers is so interesting. You can tell he loves history, and like so much of the period detail is, I think, so much of why this film is so good. But and it's got a lot of spirituality kind of woven into the story. And I think one of the first things I heard someone say about this film is that they liked it because it takes Puritanism seriously. And I thought that was an interesting way to put it. And watching the film, I think that makes sense. And it doesn't. Maybe that's what you're going to talk about. I don't want to steal your thunder about that. But it presents these people and this family who's very devout in a very realistic light. And it doesn't, you know, mock them for their faith as much as it does. You know, that faith is a big part of it, and it is, we can talk about how much or a little that their faith has to do with their undoing as a family, which is kind of where the film goes. But let's get into that third question, which is, what about this film resonates with you and with your faith?
Oh man. Well, for me, one of the biggest underlying themes of the movie that I was getting was that it's this young woman sort of coming to terms with her own power, her own sexuality, her own individuality. And for me, going through that very similar experience in high school and college, you know, really, really resonated. And just sort of, who am I outside of the faith of my parents, you know? And I really identified with that for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. That's so interesting. This time, watching it again, the the opening scene, I think, is so interesting. And so, like, basically the family is banished over a faith dispute. So first of all, I thought, you know, isn't that like the story of Christianity, is that we fight and then we split off? Like, that's if you look at like all the denominations, that's how they are all formed. It's like, we thought we were right about this point. We were more religious, we were more devout, and we're going to leave. And so, like, they're, you know, telling the father off, and he calls them false Christians. He's like, I don't care what you think, because you don't, you know, really believe in Christ. And but then what I had forgotten was like the shot of them leaving. Like, we see there's like a first person shot of, like, I guess their horse-drawn carriage thing pulling them across the field outside of the town, and like the gate shutting in their face. But then it cuts and we see Thomason, Anya Taylor-Joy, and she is just looking so despondent and like pulling away from, you know, her whole life. And I just had the sense of like, she is in a sense trapped by the actions of her father in this scene. And it's like, this is going to drastically alter her life, and it's completely out of her hands. You know, I thought that was an interesting thing that had some kind of religious trauma resonance this time around. Well, what about, are there other aspects of this film that you find, just as a cinema fan, that like, do you have favorite moments or favorite performances in this film?
Oh, Black Phillip, by far.
The yes, goat. Yes, yes.
He's so great. Love that he's just kind of chilling.
The goat is amazing.
Yeah, he's so great. But I mean, also Anya Taylor-Joy. I mean, what a film debut. She was such a powerhouse in this film.
Yeah, it's really remarkable. Her performance, like, there's a scene early on where she's praying and it's this close up, and she's just like, wow, she's so committed to this, and everyone is, like, all the accents are so amazing. Ralph Ineson, the father's voice is always incredible, and I'm just like, could just listen to him all day.
Yes.
and like, kind of gruff but somehow velvety, kind of like, just love listening to him talk. The performance I really like this time around too is the brother Caleb. So there's a couple of brothers. I guess there's Jonas and Mercy, are the young twins, and then there's Caleb and Thomason. And Caleb, he really has the crisis of faith moment too early on in the film, where the dad takes them out to see if there's anything in their trap. And at this point, so I guess a major plot point for anyone who hasn't seen it is that early on, the baby, there's a newborn that's with them. So they're banished. They go out and build a house near the woods, and where there may or may not be a witch living. And the newborn baby disappears while Thomason's watching him, Samuel. And we get a frightening sequence of what the witch does with the baby, which is horrifying. But the fallout of that is what's so interesting, I think, where Caleb is, I think it's within the week that's happened, and they've kind of given up hope that the baby's going to be saved. And he is so concerned with whether or not the baby is in heaven or hell. And I think that's something that, as my own faith has changed, is like beliefs about the afterlife and how much that affects people, and especially children. And like, if you believe, if you're told that this is how things work, and there's a certain thing waiting for you after death, depending on how you live, then that obviously that has a mental toll on you. And so I think that's, and you know, as I've questioned those things myself and come to different conclusions about, you know, we don't have to talk about whether or not we believe in the afterlife, but like, just like a belief in hell and that we deserve to go there. I think that's so damaging to kids. And so this baby hasn't been baptized yet by the time he disappears. And so he's like, oh, this baby must be in hell. And the dad kind of doesn't really know how to answer it. It seems like he just says, we don't know what God's doing. You know, we don't know. God's ways are higher than ours, or some version of
that.
And then he says something like, you know, we're so low and God is so high that we should be grateful that we have the kids we have, you know, which is such an interesting turn on that question. Yeah. But then, you know, he's saying, if this baby who's less than a week old, the brother's thinking this, is in danger of going to hell, then what does that mean for me? You know, and I've been alive this long and sinning. And so like the logical fallacies you run into with that, and how that is devastating to this child. Yeah, I really like that portion of it a lot. I'd kind of forgotten how that all went, but it really digs into those kind of spiritual conversations in the beginning of the film, before everything kind of goes wild and goes nuts at the end.
I mean, just the idea of this quote unquote sinfulness of children, like you know, Thomason's early prayers about, you know, I have sinned, but all of her sins are just typical childlike behavior. You know, sometimes I don't pray, sometimes I play on Sunday, you know, it's so absurd.
And she's, you know, and she's, you see how devout she is, because she's all by herself, you know, there's no one watching her making this prayer. Like, she really believes that this is what she's supposed to be doing. And talks about how I deserve nothing but shame and all this. And it's like, so intense, but it's like also weirdly familiar, you know, having grown up in the church. But
one of the things that really sort of kicked off my pulling away from the Southern Baptist Church was actually an experience related to the sinfulness of children. I was told, I worked as an assistant youth pastor. Wow. And I was instructed to give a hellfire sermon to a group of 10-year-olds. Wow. And I thought, nope, I'm not going to do that because they are 10. Yeah. And it was so strange. Yes, it was very familiar to me. And that was a time I actively chose not to do that.
That sounds like it put you in a really tough position, because it's so normalized that, we all deserve to go to hell. And so, you know, if that really is true, then we have to tell the kids too. And then that gets into the whole question of age of accountability, which also was a big part of my pulling away. You can see so many logical fallacies in it if you really examine it. And the big thing for me was age of accountability. So for people not familiar, that's the idea that kids reach a certain age and then they're held accountable for their sins. If they die before that, then they're still going to go to heaven, is basically the
right. So
that's kind of what I grew up learning, and it's like, I guess that must be how it is. And I think so. When I started to really question that, I was like, well, let me just look at, you know, the Bible verse about this. Guess what? There's not really one. It's something that tradition has decided based on a few different verses. Like, I can see how they pull together this logical argument, but it's not like a. You know, and that was when I started to really question the idea of inerrancy. And this film really played into those kind of questions too, for sure. Yeah. And it just kind of gets into the whole idea of, you know, what you believe about God really affects how you live. And so, we have the famous sermon, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. If we believe in a God who's primarily angry, then we should be primarily afraid. And that's how this family's living. And I think how Puritans really did see all of that. Yeah. It's powerful for that reason, that it shows a believable and like fully rounded character study of kind of people in that situation.
And just the readiness to believe that the youngest kids, Mercy and what was the other,
Jonas, person? I think
Jonas, yeah, just to their readiness to believe that they were witches too. They're like 5 years old. Amazing.
And so it's interesting too, so this is more of a filmmaking thing, but like I've heard someone say that they wish that we didn't get the witch sequence early on, and that they felt like the movie would be stronger if we didn't know whether there was really a witch, that it was, you know, a question, and that's this infighting, and seeing how, like, and in that sense it becomes like a Salem witch trial of like just blaming people and getting carried away, which I think that is pretty compelling. But I also like that it goes to that horror place, and we do see the witch, and then we see the witch's actions. And I do like that it kind of goes full horror early on, and then we kind of know what kind of film we're dealing with.
Oh, absolutely. I second that, because how often in the witch movies are you wondering, is there really a witch? Is there not? But this one, yes, there is. Here she is. Look at her. Fantastic. Exactly.
Oh, I remember what I was going to say. Just that basically, I think this movie in a way is, you know, Puritans can be so afraid of these dark spiritual forces that, you know, I generally don't believe that existed the way that they were afraid of, you know. Right. But this film is like, what if those things, what if these fears were true? What if there really is a witch out here, and like what might happen? And then where the end goes, of course, is like so intense. And I love the ending of this film.
So the
first time I saw it, I was so surprised by it. Maybe we could not spoil it just for anyone who hasn't seen it. But I really, really like the ending to the film.
Oh yeah, the ending, just Thomason's journey up to the point of speaking to the goat, and then everything after. I just thought was so cathartic to everything that she had gone through, for sure.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I think people have different reads on that. Like, I feel the same way, that I think it's like cathartic in a way. That's a good word for it, because it's you know, all the stuff she's been through, again, powerless. I think that's a good way to say, like you said earlier, she's coming into her power in this moment. And whether or not you think her decision is a good one, she's stepping into her power, and it's a big decision, you know. One thing I was going to say too is just another thing that kind of felt familiar was the kind of feeling like everything is over spiritualized, and like just mundane things we can blame on God or the devil, depending on how we feel that at that moment. The moment that I registered that was when at the beginning, when William and Caleb, the father and son, get up before everyone else. He says something, "Oh, everyone's still asleep." And he says, "On a gray day like this," because it's like cloudy outside, he says, "On a gray day, the devil holds fast your eyelids." And it's like,
right,
we're gonna blame the devil for our sleepiness because of the clouds.
Yes.
And just like, but I guess that also gets into the whole like science versus religion, and it doesn't have to be versus, right? But like, if you don't understand, like, I don't know, physiology, and when it's dark outside, we want to sleep more. That's like, that's a scientific thing, and we can just say, "Oh, it's the devil doing this."
That's fair.
So the experience you had when you refused to speak to the kids at church, I'm curious to hear more about that. So you said you were like a youth leader, or like you were a leader of the kids, is that right?
Yeah, so this was such a weird time in my life. This was like midway through college, and I was really struggling with whether I believed in this particular brand of Christianity or not. And so that summer, I really gave it 150%, and I said, if this is what I believe, I'm going to go through and do it the right way, put in all my energy. So I was a kids ministry intern. And so I spent all summer with these kids, and it was a great summer program, except for the last day where they did the big hellfire speech. And, you know, it was so striking that, you know, I had this experience of getting to know these kids as kids, and then to realize that that was what the church wanted at the end of that experience was like, it felt kind of like a betrayal in a sense. And so thankfully the kids were just by themselves with me. And I had this one little girl that was really distraught. And she said, you know, specifically came up to me and said, you know, "I'm really worried about my soul, you know." And I said, "You know what? You're 8. You don't have to worry about that right now. You just go play, and we'll talk about that when you calm down, and, you know, we can have a better talk about it." And eventually she was okay. But, you know, it really got me thinking about that whole thing. And, you know, I really felt like that's just not something that should have been even said to her. So yeah, it was such an odd thing. And I don't think I ever really talked to my boss pastor about it. I think it was just my choice to have that discussion or not with the children. But yeah, it was a real thinking moment for me as to what I wanted to do with that.
So I was wondering if you know, got in trouble or anything, but so it was just like an individual kind of group meeting, I guess.
For sure. Yeah.
Well, yeah, the hellfire and brimstone is, I don't know, just the whole, like, we're going to react out of fear, out of love. And, you know, if I'm, if you stay in your religion out of fear, it just seems seems fragile.
It really does.
So I was curious after this experience, how long did you stay with that church, or stay, you know, within evangelicalism or Southern Baptist churches in general?
Right. So that experience was a real turning point for me. I spent the rest of the summer with them just finishing out their summer camp program. But immediately after that, I went back to school and I thought, no, that path is not for me. And it really sort of, you know, sent me along my way and down the journey.
Yeah.
So yeah, maybe a couple months, I think.
Wow. So that really was kind of the beginning of the end. It sounds like, wow.
For sure. Yeah.
So it was like a summer camp kind of thing.
It was, and man, it was such a great summer camp. Other than that, it's like, it gave all the kids, they got to do like a free trips to the water park and a sports camp with like Olympic athletes that came. Like, it was so cool, all for free for the whole community, whoever wanted to except that one little last day, like just cut that out and it'd be great.
Did you ever experience the, like the, basically it's a haunted house, but they call it like a,
Hell House.
Yeah, Hell House kind of thing. Did you ever do those?
No, I never did. But years later, I got to work at an actual fun haunted house. So that that was great. Yeah.
Yes, when you pull the religious trauma out of those things, haunted house is really fun. Yeah, I love them.
Definitely.
Yeah, we had those. I attended and like I never like participated in one as an actor or anything like that. But I went through one a couple of times. I mean, it's always just so bizarre because it's like, this is normally just a bunch of, you know, people I know in youth group. And suddenly it's like a theatrical experience in our church. But talk about scaring you into heaven. Like exactly, that's exactly the goal.
Yeah.
Clearly, blatantly absolutely. The goal there. Yeah.
Love it.
So you spoke about identifying with Thomason and how she, in this film, kind of steps into her power. You know, she starts out the film very powerless and gradually, and at the end really steps into it in a big way. I was curious, like, as that parallels to your own life, do you have, were there moments along the way of your kind of spiritual journey that you felt like, this was a moment that I can remember that I made a step, an intentional step into power or claimed to power in some way?
Oh yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I know how we talked about earlier, when I went to college was a real eye-opening experience for me. One of the things that I got to do in college was actually a study abroad program in New York City.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, just getting out there into that environment. And I got to spend 6 months with artists, and at the end of it culminated with my own art show at the very end. Yeah. And it was so cool. And it just felt so powerful to be able to do that.
That's amazing. Yeah. Having those experiences where you get to be around like really diverse people. So like at college, you mentioned like that was the experience, but then I bet even more so going into an environment like that and especially being around artists, I think that's something too that I can identify a bit with is, I don't know, like this is tangential and I feel like I don't mean to take over this part of the conversation, but just like creativity in general, I think is something that wasn't necessarily valued. That's really common. Like when budget cuts happen at schools, it's the English programs that go, or it's the art programs that go. Mm-hmm. But realizing that I think there is something really special about creativity, maybe even something sacred or holy or spiritual about it. And, finding, so I guess I can identify again, I don't want to take away from your point there, but just like, stepping into power in a way or, just claiming something for my own. I think I've felt that at different moments. Well, that's really cool. Yeah. So, kind of art did you do there? Was it like paintings?
I did everything. I did drawing, collage, paintings, all different things. But you know, those experiences really got me, thinking about being an illustrator. And then now what I currently do is a tattoo artist. So
yeah. Like making totally a career great. Out of being creative. That's so cool.
Yes. Yeah. I love it.
I was just watching a very, very different movie than The Witch, but I was catching up with Oscar stuff for this year and Tick, Tick, Boom, the Jonathan Larson biopic of sorts. But it's so much of that is about, you know, should I take a creative path or do something that seems easier in some ways to like be more traditional and get a day job kind of thing. I thought that struggle in particular is really well depicted in that film. So I don't know. That just makes me think of that. I'll recommend that.
Definitely.
Movie. I was a fan of it.
So one other comment I wanted to make is on the film's treatment of the wilderness and nature. Black Phillip is such a strong presence in the film, and it's very reminiscent of the horned god of the witches, the great god Pan, embodying the earth. And at this time, there was actually a really strong belief that Puritans, that settlers needed to come through and completely conquer nature. It's actually said a couple times in the movie, "We will conquer this wilderness."
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah. And then at the end, to have, the fate of the father happen the way that it did.
Yeah.
I think that's fantastic.
Yeah. Really turning that on its head, isn't it? Wow. That's so interesting. Cause I think, when I watch like paranormal horror things, I often think, I wonder if there's true history behind this, but I never really look it up. So thanks for filling that in, because I didn't know that the wilderness connection with Black Phillip specifically. That is really cool. Well, that is The Witch, a really, really good film. Really, so much spiritual talk and faith things, I think, to draw out of it. And thanks for choosing this. I was glad to re-experience it, because it's a whole thing about, it's like a Wong Kar-wai quote that he says about editing his movies, but he compares it to like some old Chinese proverb about you never step in the same river twice, because the river's not the same and you're not the same, like every time. So like stepping back into the world of this film now versus 5 years ago is like a very different experience. So thank you for
absolutely
for prompting that again. And thanks so much for joining us. Thanks for sharing. And I really appreciate it. We'll have to have you back again and talk about something else.
Yeah, I'd love that. Thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely. Huge thanks to Kat. That was great. I'm so glad she suggested The Witch. It's a film I didn't expect to cover in this series, but it's actually a perfect fit. Well, that's all for this episode. Next time, I've got filmmaker Clayton Henderson returning to the show for a review of The Batman, starring Robert Pattinson. I'm pretty excited for that film and for that conversation with Clayton. And then I will round out this series on religion and film with one final episode. I've got a very special conversation with Rocky Roggio, director of a film called 1946, The Mistranslation That Shifted Culture. The film is a documentary about the Bible, and in particular, the word homosexual in the Bible. The film explores how that word came to be in the Bible and whether it should be there at all. The title is 1946 because that is the year the word homosexual first appeared in a Bible translation. Very interesting stuff, and I'm so excited to talk with Rocky about it, so stay tuned next time for that one. And with that, thank you for listening to Arthouse Garage. We've got a few years worth of episodes now, and you can hear all of those in your podcast app of choice. Our theme music is by composer Paul Hunefeld. Learn more at appallingproductions.com. If you want to support Arthouse Garage, leave a rating or review in your podcast app. Or you can buy an Arthouse Garage t-shirt at arthousegarage.com/shop. Stay in the loop about Arthouse Garage and the films we're covering by subscribing to our email newsletter. That is at arthousegarage.com/subscribe. Or you can email me directly, andrew@arthousegarage.com. And of course, follow on social media. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Letterboxd. Just search at Arthouse Garage in all those places, or find links in the show notes. And that will do it for this episode. Thank you again so much for listening. And until next time, keep it snob free.